We're now beginning a study of the 26th Psalm. The title of this Psalm tells us that it was written by David. And we have no reason to doubt that David wrote it, although there's nothing in the contents of the Psalm itself that specifically tells us this. We can determine, though, very easily what the state of mind was of the one who wrote this. Here was a person who was giving some very deep thought, some very studied concentration on the fact of how did his righteousness stand up in the sight of God? Was he truly a holy person? Was he truly one that was found faithful in the sight of God? And as he meditates upon his personal state of holiness, upon his own individual righteousness, he wonders whether the evidences that he has to show that he is holy and that he is righteous, whether these evidences are genuine. And he wonders whether he may rely upon these evidences as justifying his hope of salvation. These are questions that all of God's people will have from time to time as we meditate and wonder about what our true condition is in the presence of God. Then this is a wonderful little psalm to guide us as we have these thoughts. And as he thinks along this line, he asks God to judge him, to judge his case, to see whether or not he then is justified in his position of declaring that he is truly a follower of God. So in verse 1 he says, "Judge me, O Lord, for I have walked in mine integrity. I have trusted also in the Lord. Therefore I shall not slide." So he begins by immediately asking the Lord to judge him. That is to try his case, to take a look at his situation, to see whether or not he lived up to the standards that God wanted to live up to. And as he asks God to do this, as he wants God to give him a thorough examination and to pass some kind of a judgment about whether or not he is acceptable to him, he also tells what his state is of trying to live the righteous life. He says, "For I have walked in mine integrity." The word integrity here means uprightness or sincerity. So he hasn't carelessly lived. He hasn't flagrantly violated or disobeyed God's will, but his life has rather been one of sincerity. His life has been one of uprightness and integrity, and so he, in his own mind, feels like he's been doing the right thing. But, of course, he realizes, as we all do, that many times we can be deceived. We can think that we're doing what's right. We can think that we're doing what is proper because we're so sincere about it, because we're so eager to want to please God, and yet at the same time we may be deceived. So he's not asking God to judge him because he knows that he's been wrong, because he realizes things that need to be changed in his life. Those we judge for ourselves. But he's asking God to judge him because he feels like he's been doing the proper thing, and he wants God now to pass on whether or not this is a genuine righteous state. He further says in verse 1, "I have trusted also in the Lord." So not only does he feel like he's been living the right kind of a life of uprightness and sincerity and having integrity, but he also states that he has trusted in the Lord. He has not neglected God. He has not failed to use God as his shield, as his succorer, and realize that he is the true and holy one and only God. He hasn't gone aside into idolatry or into infidelity, but he's trusted in the Lord. Even so, in this state of trust that he has in the Lord, there's still that chance that he might have done something that's improper. There's that chance that he might have been deceived, misled, so that he is not truly acceptable to God. And so he's asking God to judge me, O Lord. "So I have trusted also in the Lord, therefore I shall not slide." He doesn't have any fear of falling or sliding. He's very confident in what he's doing. He doesn't have any doubt in what he's doing, but still he asks God to give him this judgment, to pass upon his case. And so it is with us. We must be doing the things that we know that are right. If our own conscience condemns us, then there's no use to go any further. We need to make some changes. We either need to change our beliefs so that our conscience doesn't condemn us, or we need to change our actions so that our actions coincide with what we do believe. And so we know that we got a problem if our own conscience condemns us. But when we feel like that we're doing what is proper and right, when we feel like that we're safe and secure in the thing that we're doing, we still have reason to want God to judge us. we still know that there is that possibility we could be deceived, we could be misled some way or another. And so it's always well then to take an inventory as to how we truly do stand in the sight of God, to gain any further information we might can get from God, any new facts, any new area of knowledge that we can apply to ourselves to see what our true position is as we serve the great God. He further says in verse 2, "Examine me, O Lord, and prove me, try my reins and my heart." So he's asking for an examination of the most meticulous kind. He uses three words in this verse: examine, prove, and try. So even though he states that he's walked in his uprightness and sincerity and integrity, even though he says, "I've trusted in the Lord and I shall not slide," he still is asking God to give him a very thorough judgment. Examine me, O Lord. This is a word that's used commonly in the testing of metals, putting metals to the test to see how genuine they are, to see how free they are from imperfections. And so this is what he's asking God to do. Examine me, O Lord. Whatever test you might need to use on me or on my case, see whether or not I am genuine. He further says, prove me. And this word prove, if it has a root that we'd want to change it to, would mean to smell. That is another way of testing to see what kind of quality that I am. It's just another way of asking God to thoroughly determine His nature, His character, His righteousness. So prove me. And then he says, try my reins and my heart. Here again, this word try is another one that can be used in the testing of metals to determine their genuineness and their purity, their quality. So try my reins and my heart. The word here for reins really means the inward organs of the body, such as the kidneys. And in the Hebrew sense, this meant the affections. This was the part of him that had to do with his feelings. This was the part of him that had to do with his emotions. And it was reflected then in his activity as he dealt with other persons. Did he have the proper feelings and affections toward others? Did he show them the right amount of love, the right amount of concern and care? Was he truly interested in them as a person and in their well-being? So try my reins or my affections. And then he says, and my heart. And the word for heart in the Hebrew really means the intelligence or the knowledge part. This would be our mind or our ability to think. What kind of a doctrine do we hold? What kind of a philosophy is ours? Do we know enough? Do we know the truth? Are we being deceived or misled in the things that we believe and practice and teach others to do? So he's asking God to try him from every aspect, my feelings, my emotions, and try my mind, my intelligence. Test me to see whether or not I really am in accordance with what is true and what is real. So these first two verses are simply showing how the writer of this psalm is asking God to judge him, to examine him, to try him, to prove him, to see whether or not his righteousness is genuine. And it's a very proper thought for us to have. As we meditate upon our true state in the sight of God, we should desire that God would give us the same kind of an examination. But what if we are wrong? What if we are being misled or deceived in some way? What if we're holding something to be a practice, to be a part of our philosophy that God doesn't want us to have? Now is the time to find out about it. There's no use to go any further doing something that's not right and proper. So let's examine ourselves, or let's have God to examine us. Let's put our life in the limelight. Let's put it out so that it can be meticulously dissected and gone over to see whether or not it is proper. And that's what the psalmist is doing here. And it's a very appropriate thought to have. It's one that a person would truly have to be full of integrity and righteousness and want to be right to ask God to give him this kind of an examination. Those who would tend to hide from God, those who tend to cover up the faults and the flaws in their lives, those who tend to slide over the proper and right thing to do, they are not really going to be genuine and sincere. But here's a person that has a true, sincere feeling about wanting to be right, wanting to be acceptable to God, and so he asked God to give him this judgment. Now, as you move into verse 3, we see that the psalmist begins to give evidences of his righteousness. He begins to show the things that are in his life that to him seem to show that he's doing the right thing. And so if these evidences are not correct, if they are not proper, then he wants God to let him know, because he in his own mind is convinced that he's doing the proper thing. His own conscience doesn't condemn him. He's living according to what he knows, and he then lays his case out before God as he asks for this examination. So verse 3 says, "For thy loving kindness is before mine eyes, and I have walked in thy truth." This statement, "thy loving kindness is before mine eyes," shows that the writer of this psalm truly looked for the blessings of God. He felt as though he was being blessed by God. He sought after the divine favor, and so he makes the statement, "Thy loving kindness is before mine eyes. I'm continually looking to you for blessings. I am depending upon you, and I feel that you have given me these blessings." He further says, "And I have walked in thy truth." Everything that I do, I feel that I'm in the truth. I feel that I am in accordance with thy will. I do not flagrantly violate or disobey those things that I believe to be the truth. I've walked in thy truth. And so this is the feeling that we should all have. We should all have the feeling that we do have this close association with God, that we are continually in his favor, that we do have his loving kindness before our eyes, and that we're walking in his truth. But even though we have this feeling, even though we truly believe this, it is still proper, it is still appropriate for us to seek for the searching eye of God to give us an examination, to give us a test as to see whether or not we really are doing the proper thing. How wonderful it would be to be able to have God to show us, yes, you are doing the very thing I want you to do, or no, you're not doing what I want. I want you to make some changes. And so this is an appropriate feeling to have, even though we feel so secure, even though we feel so right and so correct, even though we are so confident that we're doing the proper thing, and we should be confident that we're doing the proper thing. But nevertheless, there's still always that area in which we can stand to be tried and tested and examined to see whether or not we're doing what is proper. He further says, as he shows these evidences of his righteousness to God, even though he's asking to be tested, he's showing God that this is what he bases his feeling that he's right upon. In verse 4 he says, "I have not sat with vain persons, neither will I go in with dissemblers." Here's another evidence as to why he thought he was holy and righteous in the sight of God. "I have not sat with vain persons." Vain persons would be those that are false or hollow, those that are hypocrites, those that are pretenders, those that are not genuine in what they are doing or believing. And he says, "I've not sat with them." That is, I have not kept company with them. I've not made them my companions. I have not habitually stayed in their presence. I have not sat with them. He may have had to have encountered them in his daily business affairs. He may have had to have encountered them in many endeavors, but it wasn't a matter of him choosing them for his friends and going in and sitting with them and enjoying their company. "I've stayed away from these kind of persons. These are not my kind of people. These are not my friends." He further says, "Neither will I go in with dissemblers." The word dissemblers means those that disguise or hide their true selves. They hide their true motives. They truly are hypocrites. They're those that may appear on the surface to be righteous, but they really are not. They're not genuine. And so he says, "I haven't gone in with them." So I do not sit with them, and I do not go in with them. That is, I do not really keep company by going to their place of entertainment or their place of abode and spending time with them in a casual or enjoyable manner so that I have been said to go in with them. And what he's simply saying here is that he has stayed away from those that are ungodly. He doesn't choose them as his friends. He doesn't choose them as his associates. And this is one of his proofs to God that he feels that he's all right. One of the reasons why he thinks that his case is going to be satisfactorily passed upon by God. But nevertheless, he still Even in view of this, he still wants God to examine and to try his situation. Again, he says in verse 5, I have hated the congregation of evildoers and will not sit with the wicked. Here he gives even a stronger evidence of the same thing that he talked about in verse 4, where there he says, I will not have not sat with vain persons, and neither will I go in with dissemblers. Here he says, I have hated the congregation of evildoers. He shows that he has an absolute dislike for them. He has no pleasant feelings or regards for what they're doing. This congregation of evildoers would be any assembly of persons that have come together for the wrong purpose, that have come together for the improper reasons, whether it be to do others harm, whether it be to plot some kind of mischief or violence, whether it be to worship the wrong God, or maybe even to worship God in the wrong way. He has no sympathy with them. He has no part. He will not do anything to enhance that assembly. He will not do anything to further it, to make it feel like that it may be all right, for he has this feeling of hatred toward it. I have hated the congregation of evildoers, and will not sit with the wicked. I will not take my place with the wicked. I will not be found giving them any kind of support. I will not be found lending them my presence. I won't sit with them. I will not show any favor toward them. My mind is opposed to what they're doing. They're not going to misinterpret my actions to think that maybe I do think they're all right after all, for I will not sit with them, and I've hated the congregation of evildoers. And he's simply showing here that for a person to be able to tell God that he thinks he's doing what's right, that he thinks he is doing what is proper, he must then be living the kind of life in which he's staying away from those that are not righteous, those that are improper. He cannot be found supporting the kinds of entertainment or the kinds of activity that the wicked are doing that's contrary to God. Any congregation, any assemblage of persons that is for the purpose of doing something that's not proper, then we should not have ourselves associated with that. We should hate this assembly. We should hate this gathering of persons, and certainly not lend it credence and give it honor by our presence and by our support. And when it comes to making a choice as to whether we're going to support and give comfort to the wicked and the bad things that they're doing, then we must take the position that we'll not sit with the wicked. I will not take my place with them, but I'm going to remain separate and apart from them and keep myself holy and pure in the sight of God. And these are reasons that he gives now as to why he thinks that his position is a righteous one. Now, if he is violating one of these principles that he names here, then he doesn't have to ask God for any more judgment. He feels quite sure that he's doing the wrong thing. But here's a person that's doing the thing that he thinks is right, and he's naming what he's doing that's right. He's naming what he feels are major principles of righteousness, and then he still, on top of that, asks God to examine him, to try him, and to judge him. In verse 6, he gives more reasons why he feels that he is going to be justified, that he is going to be able to stand this great test that he's asking God to put him through. He there says, I will wash mine hands in innocency, so will I compass thine altar, O Lord. Now this phrase, will wash mine hands in innocency, is simply an emblem of purity. It is a way of saying that I'm going to keep myself pure and holy. I'm going to keep myself free of sins and those things that are displeasing unto thee, those things that are going to cause a blot to be upon my character, upon my life. I'm going to keep myself clean of them. We see this demonstrated by Pilate at the trial of Jesus in Matthew 27, beginning with the 24th verse. When Pilate saw that he could prevail nothing, but rather a tumult was made, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this just person. See ye to it. Then answered all the people and said, His blood be on us and on our children. So the washing of hands is a symbol of purifying oneself and of remaining free of guilt. And he says here, I will wash my hands in innocency. This phrase in innocency may mean that he's going to use pure water, that he's going to use water that will not recontaminate himself. And it simply means that he is going to be free from sins. And he further says, so will I compass thine altar, O Lord. that accomplish the altar could mean one of two things. Either he will embrace this altar with his arms, or he will walk around this altar as the worship is being given. It was the custom of the priest to walk around the altar while the offering was being made upon it. This demonstrated their interest and their activity and their attentiveness to the things of God. And so the writer is simply saying that he's going to be in that same position, that he is going to be most attentive to the things of God, to the service of God, and to this offering that's made upon the altar. So one of the evidences that he produces to show that he has been a righteous person and that he will be able to stand this trial and test of God is that he is one who worships God, that he is one who does compass the altar, but not only that, but that he worships God with clean hands. That is, he is free of guilt, he is free of sin, he is an innocent person, and he remains in this righteous condition while in the act of worship. Now, it's one thing to worship God and do it in a hypocritical way, to do it in a vain way, to do it improperly, and not really with a love for God, but simply to make a show of it. But this person here is most sincere. This person compasses the altar. This person pays attention. He has all of his mind and all of his body dedicated to the worship. And at the same time, then, he is one that comes with clean hands. And when we worship this same God today, we must come with this same sense of innocency, the same sense of purity and holiness as we carry out the worship that he's prescribed for us today. We're going to close at that point. Till next time, this is NC Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.